Good afternoon from NPR Music and the new classical blog called Deceptive Cadence. I'm Tom Heisinger. Robin Hilton from NPR Music also here with me. Sorry we got a little bit of a late start. Music we're hearing right now, it's a brand new recording of the Violin Concerto by Jennifer Higdon, performed by violinist Hilary Hahn. The concerto won the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for Music, and we are lucky to have both the composer and the performer with us for the next hour or so, Hilary Hahn and Jennifer Higdon. Hilary Hahn, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer Higdon, welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I should mention right away that we also have a chat room happening on this page, so please join in and take a moment to write in a question or two for Hilary and Jennifer. You can ask them about the music on the new CD on Deutsche Grammophon, which also contains the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. The record is released tomorrow. We're streaming the whole thing on our site, nprmusic.org, right now in its entirety. So, Jennifer, it's been about 5 months since the Pulitzer was put in your hands. Has it all begun to sink in yet?
It's starting to. I have to admit there are moments, though, where I'm still caught off guard when I see my name attached to the Pulitzer word. So it's getting there.
What does a Pulitzer look like?
Actually, I think it's just the idea of it.
You don't get any statue or trophy?
They actually have a little crystal statue they give you.
Oh,
but
okay.
What's amazing is every time I see my name in print now, that's actually attached to it. Not the statue, but the name.
Right. I mean, what do? They just call your cell phone one morning and they say, oh, we're the Pulitzer folks, and by the way, you've won.
Actually, no, it doesn't happen that way at all. They don't notify you. The press notifies you. Announce it. Yeah, they announce it at 3 o'clock on a specific day, and the press descends on you wanting a comment. So you don't have warning because there are deadlines usually within the next hour or two. So you find out because so many people start calling, and so you have to think. First of all, you have to collect yourself because it's a pretty surprising event to have happen, and try to think of something clever to say when you have so much adrenaline in your system, you think, oh, I can't really function. I got a letter like 3 or 4 days later from the Pulitzer Committee to say, this is to confirm that you've won the Pulitzer Prize. And I thought, oh, thank goodness for that. I might have been commenting on something.
It wasn't a crank
wasn't
phone
there.
Call.
Yeah.
Now, Hilary, you were a major part of this concerto. It was written for you, and the Pulitzer was based on a world premiere performance that you had given in Indianapolis in February of last year. How did you find out that Jennifer and you had won? Did Jennifer call you?
I got a call in New Zealand.
Wow.
I was in the middle of doing some post-production work on the album, and I was under tight deadlines for turning some of that stuff in to the record company. So I was kind of over my head because I was already, I was doing that and I was in the middle of a tour with the orchestra, and suddenly they're asking me for comments on the Pulitzer. I'm thinking, but that's great. And I was really excited that it had won, and I was completely surprised because I know that pieces win Pulitzers, but I just never been associated with something that had. So it was really a great surprise for me. But then I'm thinking, when am I going to do these? Like, they want things now. And when do I have time now to give a quote? So it kind of hit me a lot as well. But I think Jennifer had the majority of the requests coming to her. But I was I was completely caught off guard as well. Very exciting.
Jennifer, has it made a difference in your career already?
Well, my career was going along actually pretty actively. There was a lot going on, but I tell you, the difference actually was because I run my own publishing company, the number of sales of all of my music shot up dramatically. And so there has been a lot of interest, and suddenly I had all these recording projects that were in early, early stages. A lot of them got fast-tracked. So,
and more people want to play your music, it sounds like.
Yes, definitely. There's been an uptick in that and a lot of commission offers. So, but I don't have a single complaint about my career. Even before this happened, there was a lot happening. So I actually have had to turn down quite a bit of stuff.
And you get into better restaurants now, probably.
Actually, believe it or not, that's actually happened a couple of times.
Really?
I was recognized and moved up to the front of the line. So
nice.
Now, Jennifer, you've written a lot of music already. You said your career's been going quite well, and it has. Various concertos, chamber pieces, choral works. Do you kind of know, and you were just telling me earlier that you just finished a piece this weekend. Do you know when you've written something especially good? Do you get that a certain feeling like, ah, oh, this one's great?
You know, I don't ever have that sensation. My thoughts always, I hope this works the way I calculated it to work. And I'm always anxious to make sure it works for the performer and the audience that is communicating with the audience. So I won't know that until we get into the premiere of a piece. So I usually have doubts, actually, when I let a piece go. I always have some sort of doubt. In fact, usually the act of putting it in the mail is a little agonizing because it means I can't be writing on it. I have to kind of let someone else take over. So it's, I know a lot of people have wondered, do you know immediately? And the truth is you actually just don't know.
Let's listen to some of the concerto now. And I'd like to start right at the top of the piece. It's quite a subtle yet, I think, stunning opening. And for the listeners, please pay attention to some of the very cool sounds that Jennifer Higdon writes into this opening. And after we hear it, just about 2 minutes of it, just before the strings come in, we'll see if we can get Jennifer and Hillary to tell us just how they did it. I love that moment when the strings come in and it's a very warm feeling. It's the opening of Jennifer Higdon's Violin Concerto, written for and performed there by Hillary Hahn from a brand new release. It's coming out tomorrow, but you can hear it in its entirety here on NPRmusic.org. Jennifer Higdon and Hillary Hahn are with us this afternoon. Hillary, beginning with you, what's happening right at the very top of that concerto?
When it starts, I'm playing harmonics, which are... What I was just listening to it right now, and it occurred to me it's a little bit like one of those hearing tests, you know, where you have the high tones and you have to pick out where they are. But it's much more artistic and musical than that. So in that part, those high tones that you hear, those are harmonics. So that's a kind of a technical trick on the violin. And then you hear in the background, Jennifer can tell you what you're hearing.
That's right, Jennifer. You told me you like to hang around in the percussionist's practice room at Curtis Institute where you teach, and I think some of those sounds might come from some experiments in that room, perhaps?
That's right. I love percussion in all of my pieces, but this one I decided to give something to go along with those fantastic harmonics that Hillary is playing on her instrument. I thought, wouldn't it be nice to have high percussion? So I used Glockenspiel, which is like a concert bell with like a little metal slat. And then also crotales, which are round. And they sound like the concert bells, except they're much brighter. And when we first read through this, it was a little too much sound. It was starting to sound like a dentist drill. So I had the idea to actually switch the percussionist mallets to knitting needles, have them play with knitting needles. And it's a very light sort of sound. It's exactly the sound I was looking for. But it's kind of funny. I thought, you know, leave it to composers to kind of obsess about sound and how can you achieve something, even if you have to run out to an art supply store and buy knitting needles. So,
now, how did you think of knitting needles? Do you knit by any chance?
I don't knit at all. And I've never been around anyone who does. So I think it's just a matter of trying to problem solve. I had calculated a sound and it wasn't being achieved, so I tried to think of something else that might work, something the shape of a mallet that a percussionist would use. And that just popped into my head.
And then maybe you can tell us what the crotale is, and you've balanced it on the head of a timpani, right?
That's right. It's known as a timpano effect. You put this little disc that has this pure pitch right in the middle of the timpani head. You strike actually the crotale, not the timpani head, with a metal mallet, and then you move the timpani's pedal. It makes this little wave sound. And it's great to put in pieces because you see the audience kind of looking around trying to figure out, where does that sound come from?
That was me in the first rehearsal. What is that sound? And so you'll notice after that initial start with the crotales and the glockenspiel and the violin harmonics, the harmonics continue and then there's a sustained violin. But what Jennifer does is she gives me the sustained part and turns the harmonic section over to the concertmaster, so the first violinist in the orchestra. So things are continuing and layering, starting to layer on top of each other, but it would be easy to just have, you know, the concertmaster do the sustained solo, but it's really interesting to pass it off.
Right, you switch off between,
right. Yeah, so that one thing seems to be continuing, but visually when you're looking at it, you don't know where it went. You have to figure it out.
And we talked a little bit about Curtis Institute, where Jennifer, you teach, and the seeds of this concerto were sown, so to speak, quite a few years ago at Curtis, right?
Right, that's right. When Hillary was actually in my 20th century music class, that was probably where it sprung from. It took a while, too.
15 years ago.
Yeah, it has been a while, though, so it takes a little while it's like careful planting of a field, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I was telling someone this morning that when you're working with a new idea of a piece, it could be anything, and it can take place anytime. So it's not like you already know you're going to do this and that, and you just have to schedule it. It's actually, well, what are we going? Are we going to do a sonata? Are we going to do a chamber work, a solo piece? What kind of, if we're going to do a concerto, what kind of concerto? And then how are we going to organize the commission of it all? And so I think we're just trying to figure it out a little bit on our own separately, and then we decided to do a concerto, and then we started the ball rolling. That's the way I remember.
Yeah, that's accurate.
If you've just joined us, it's Jennifer Higdon, composer, who won the Pulitzer this year, earlier this year, for her violin concerto, and written for Hilary Hahn, who's also here with us this afternoon. It's NPR Music. Tom Heisinger with you, and we'd love to answer some of your questions on the chat room on this page, so write them in, and we'll get to some of them in a moment. Jennifer, how do you actually, you know, start writing a piece of music? I mean, this piece in particular, those first notes, is there an inspiration? Are you scribbling them down on paper? You have your composing software open, or?
For me, it always starts at a piano, trying to find some sort of interesting line or a chord progression. And in this particular piece, it was the second movement that started it for me. I knew I wanted to do something with a interesting chord progression, and I literally wrote like six or seven different kinds of chord progressions until I found one that sounded interesting enough to sustain through an entire movement. But it's a lot of daydreaming, and it's trying to figure out. I do a lot of sketching with pencil and manuscript, and at some point, usually maybe 30 seconds into the music, once I've written that, I actually start entering it into the computer, into a music software notation program, and the ideas start coming fast enough that I can put them in straight into the computer at that point. But the piano is always there. I'm always going back and checking things and trying to figure out what's interesting to listen to, what works on the instrument, what would fit Hillary, what shows off what she does well, which is just about everything. So it is a lot of daydreaming, and some of the music I have no idea where it comes from. I'm sometimes really surprised when I hear it afterwards. I'm like, where did that music come from?
So the first music that you actually put to paper for this is the opening of the second movement, and let's take a little listen to that. And it's, the new recording is Vasily Petrenko leading the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic, and it's the opening from the second of the three movements of Jennifer Higdon's violin concerto. Listening to the opening of the second movement of Jennifer Higdon's violin concerto with Hilary Hahn as the soloist. And Jennifer, it kind of struck me interestingly that this is the first music you said you wrote for the concerto, and yet, you know, it's actually not for the violin at all. You've got a solo, kind of a solo cello situation happening there at the top, and then some nice work for winds, including flute.
Yeah, you know, I knew this would be the second movement, and I figured the violin would be playing a lot in the first, so I thought, all right, I knew I wanted to have a lot of solos in the second movement, but I thought I have to find a way to set this up and to kind of make it sound special, so when Hilary comes in, it's a very distinctive sound. So there's kind of an awareness when you're writing something like this that you need to place the solos well within the context of the entire piece. So I knew since she'd been playing a lot in the first movement, that was my plan, that having a small break at the beginning, once she comes back in the second move, would make it sound special, actually, make it sound fresh.
When I enter in the second movement, actually, which is right after where we stopped listening, the violin part isn't immediately flashy. It doesn't jump in and say, okay, here I am. It works its way into what the orchestra has already established. And it continues throughout the piece with a lot of chamber elements in the orchestra.
And there is plenty of flashiness in the piece, too, we should say. And we'll
right,
listen
right.
to some of that in a moment. But
not all of it.
I'm going to turn to Robin Hilton from NPR Music is here with me this afternoon. And we've been having quite a few questions come in the live chat room. Robin, do you have a few interesting ones coming
in? Yeah, this question comes from Mike, and it's for Hilary. He says, why did you choose the original version of the Tchaikovsky? What are the differences compared to the commonly played later version?
Well, I guess that requires a little explanation behind the question. The Tchaikovsky concerto, which I recorded also for this album, was revised by a famous violinist and pedagogue, Leopold Auer. So what he did in his revision was he took some cuts. He left out some material he felt was maybe too repetitive, and he embellished other things that he thought needed a little more showiness. And so that's a version that he then, I suppose, taught to his students, and a lot of people have played since then. That's the version that I learned as a student. And as I was working on the Tchaikovsky concerto, I took a long break from it kind of by accident for probably about 10 years. When I came back to it in my mid-20s, I started looking at the score really carefully, because at that point you don't want to just play what you remember. You want to actually, after 10 years, you want to check that you're still playing the right things. And so I looked at the music, and I noticed in a different way where the differences were from the Auer edition and the the supposed original Tchaikovsky edition. And one detail at a time, I just started trying the original. And I found that one detail at a time, I preferred the original at that time. So I just wound up making the decision through gradually arriving there that I would play the original version. And I like a lot of the structural things that were altered in the hour edition. I like them in the original form. So I find it's a more effective piece for me at this point, the way Tchaikovsky wrote it.
Another question from a listener named Boris, who writes that, as for the Tchaikovsky, it seems to be viewed by some as mostly a piece for technical showmanship more than anything else that does not compare to, say, Brahms or Beethoven's concertos.
I've never heard of it that way.
I have never heard of it that way either.
I mean, I hear people talk about Paganini that way, and I disagree even there. But the Tchaikovsky, it's a very popular work for good reason. It's got a lot of emotional range. I think it is very close to a lot of people. They feel very nostalgic when they hear it because they've heard it for years. And there are a lot of different ways you can play it and still bring out that range of emotion. The technique in anything should never be the focus, I think, if that's what the audience is noticing first and foremost. Maybe the approach isn't as conducive to the music as it could be. Some pieces have the technique in the foreground and people notice anyway, and that's fine. But I think as a player, I always have to consider the technique as serving the musical purpose. So not a distraction, but rather an enhancement.
This is another question from a listener named Jari, and it's for Jennifer. He says, I read that the 1726 title of the first movement is a Curtis reference. Are there any hidden musical themes or ideas from your time at Curtis in that movement?
No, actually, it was just in the title. The 1726 refers to the address of Curtis, 1726 Locust. But I did make sure, in order to kind of reflect the title, I used a lot of sevenths and seconds and sixths in that movement, just kind of as a way. I always try something different in everything I write, so it was kind
of there are ones all over the place.
And that's right, absolutely. But that's basically it. I was thinking about the fact that a new work is something that's being born into the world, and it was kind of cool that it had basically come out of Curtis. I had gone to school there, Hillary went to school there, and I had taught Hillary there in my class, so something about that, since it was the opening, just seemed kind of appropriate.
And when you're going to a building, what's the first thing you know about it? Its address.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Do you remember first impressions of each other when you met in that 20th century music class?
I think we met before. We probably met in the hallway or passed each other.
Curtis is pretty small. It's about 140, 160 students, so everyone gets to know everyone else. But the one thing I do remember is that Hillary was inquisitive. She was hungry to know, and she wasn't sure what she was going to think about new music, but she was open to the idea of talking about it and learning. So it was you remember those students. There's kind of a bright look in their eyes. Actually, it's quite different than you sometimes find with students.
Jennifer, I remember that you were very supportive of students who were curious. Some teachers have to go after class. Like, they just take off and they'll talk in class, but more in a sort of a teaching way, not in a discussion way. And if anyone had questions, not just me, but other kids too, I remember that would lead to a fair discussion of the issues surrounding those questions. And so I learned a lot from that as well.
Probably didn't come to mind then that you would be collaborating on a violin concerto 15 years later.
No, it didn't, actually. I was, but you know what? I never think about things like that.
Kind of not. I mean, it's not like we could have said, oh, look at us 15 years from now. This is what we'll be doing. But I think I thought about, well, this is a composer who's, you know, got wonderful music and is very successful, and hopefully my career works out, and you know, we might wind up working together sometime. But definitely that year, you were my teacher.
Yeah, yeah.
The music that we heard just a few moments ago from the second movement, here and there and in other places, a concerto somehow sounded very American to me. And I wonder if that was just me or Jennifer, Hillary, do you think it has...
What do you mean by American?
Well, I felt like there were these kind of open, spacious chords, a little wistful, but full of promise, maybe a little Barber-like, a little Copeland-like?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, people ask me about this all the time, and it's the music is so prominent in my own head that it's hard for me to articulate what is American, but everyone points that out. And I'm not sure. It has something to do with the harmonies, and I think I am influenced by Barber and Copeland and
Other people, too, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. So it's an interesting question, and I think it's probably easier for other people to peg who are on the outside because mm-hmm. it just sounds like the music from my head, and I'm American, so so maybe for me, yeah, definitely American, but other people do hear it because I get asked about that a lot.
Well, I think it is very, you know, one thing that it is, it's very listenable, it's very accessible, it's very likable music, and you know, in the past, you've made no bones about the fact that you really want your audience to know where they are in your music. And actually, it wasn't too long ago, you know, it was a number of decades ago, that it was quite unfashionable to write music like this. I mean,
right.
Tonal music, the influence of the serialists lasted a very long time. And some of that attitude, I think, has still stuck around with some critics and observers kind of looking down on those who write tonal music, accessible music. What do you say to those folks?
Can I just jump in
sure.
and say that to me, it doesn't seem particularly tonal or atonal. I mean, I think of tonal as something that's in a definite key that, you know, starts on a certain note, ends on a certain note, and from there you know that all the chord progressions are going to be within this relative key or that key, and I don't hear that. There's a lot of chromaticism. I mean, I don't know how tonal it is to write a cadenza with like sevenths and ninths.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it does give a tonal impression, so I'm not even mm-hmm. sure what that means. And then also, from the inside of the piece, it's very complex. So it may seem really accessible and open and straightforward, but it also has this nature that changes a little bit every time you hear it because of the amount of things that are worked into every second.
Yeah, you know, I think that question, you're right, there have been some people who've been critical of, but you know what, the thing is, it's art. There should be all kinds of expression. I don't think we need to have one school or another, and that's the thing I kind of like about contemporary music now. There's all kinds of languages going out there, and I find them mm-hmm. all fascinating, and why not explore them all? If you don't like one type of language, you can find something else. I think we have more of a problem if someone's saying it can only be one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I like having lots of different things. I mean, a perfect example, the opening, the harmonics that Hillary plays, I actually got the idea for doing that from listening to her recording of the Schoenberg. It's such a stunning recording.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, wow, these harmonics are fantastic. Now, the Schoenberg is about as different from my concerto as it gets, but that's where I kind of got the inspiration, the leaping off point for that opening movement. But I think having all kinds of different styles is a much, much preferable situation for everybody, performers, listeners, and just people in general.
Yeah, it's fascinating as a performer to have all these options.
It's funny that you mentioned the Schoenberg because when I first heard the opening section of the movement of the violin concerto, I thought, oh my goodness, it sounds like a tone row. And I thought, where is it going to go from here? Because it really does sound like, you know, you were adopting that serialist technique there for a few moments with those solo vibrato-less sounds. Let's talk a little bit about how you two collaborated. Now, of course, the Tchaikovsky concerto on the disc, Hillary, you can't, you know, go back and ask for any advice from the composer there. But when you're playing music composed for you by a living composer, you do have that chance to be more involved. And I'm wondering how much back and forth and what kind of collaboration you two got into for the violin concerto.
Well, when you work on something with a living composer, you realize that there is no one way to interpret a piece, and the composer doesn't have all of the answers. The composer has some very helpful tips and is very helpful. Like Jennifer was really helpful when I was asking generally interpretively, what's the impression you want to convey here? Just so that I would know where she was coming from in forming my interpretation. But often I find if I ask a composer, what did you mean by this note? Or what do you want me to do here? They're curious to hear how I want to play it, and a lot of them don't necessarily want to dictate how it should be, but they do have very helpful input. So it's nice to have the option of asking someone a question at the same time as a as a performer interpreting music, I have to eventually come up with an interpretation that works for me, that I feel like I can bring across convincingly. So it's a combination of being informed and then also just starting from scratch on my own.
It's a fascinating process because I actually went off and wrote each of the movements and sent them to Hillary. I mean, it's nice because we actually know each other. So there's kind of a difference there than what you would have if you were meeting a performer for the first time and trying to learn about that performer to write for them. We had an advantage that doesn't normally exist. And so I knew Hillary enough that I could go off and write. And there were actually very few changes. At one point in the second movement, you asked me to add an additional line, so two lines running simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And but other than that, I mean, it was pretty impressive. She said, it's my job to learn it, so I will.
Yeah, and I really wanted Jennifer to write what she wanted to write and not worry too much about how I wanted to play it while she was creating, because I think it is helpful to have artistic license and artistic freedom when you're writing something.
So, Jennifer, you said that Hillary asked for a couple of changes in the second movement, right?
Right.
Like alterations.
Yeah.
Right. What Hillary, why did you ask for those? I'm wondering.
I like playing double stops, and I didn't have many double stops, so I was like, can I play something simultaneously polyphonic, please? Well, just that. You know, I just thought it would be nice.
It's a pretty amazing thing for you to be a composer and look at a line and say, I'm going to add a line to this, but she executes it beautifully. I mean, it could be like two players actually doing it. It's pretty impressive.
But you're very picky about your notes.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't go in as the performer. Some composers are very flexible with, especially like film composers, because things are always changing and they have to write really quickly. I could go in and say, well, what do you think of this or that? But with your music, it's better if I ask for something or make a suggestion, and then you go and do it, because it's amazing how much she knows exactly where she wants every note to be, and it makes you realize how much thought really goes into an entire piece like this.
Thank you.
So, Jennifer, when Hillary came to you and asked for a little adjustment there, then how much time did it take you to do that?
You know, we were actually in Toronto. I remember this. We were in a hotel room. We were going through performances, and for me to add those lines, I mean, it wasn't a tremendous amount, but it actually took me probably 3 or 4 hours. I kept trying things and trying to figure out, all right, does this work? Does this help the line? Is this awkward? So it took me a couple of hours, and I remember creating a PDF file and sending it to Hillary's email, and we were like in separate rooms, but we're like checking, looking at the PDF and talking about it.
Because you can't talk the notes through. You have to look at it.
Right, exactly. Well,
do you hear the changes in your head when you're making them, or do you have to hear them played back?
I actually hear them in my head, but I had to adjust because I gotten used to hearing in my head the single line I had written in those spots. And suddenly to add another line was a very jarring experience. So I had to kind of step back and give it time to get used to it.
Hmm. Well, let's hear those lines, actually. From the second slow movement of Jennifer Higdon's Violin Concerto with Hillary Hahn. The little changes that Jennifer asked Hillary to make, or that
the other way
Hillary
around.
Asked Jennifer to make.
I would have made changes gladly, but she didn't ask me.
Here we go. Just a little bit of music there from the second movement of Jennifer Higdon's Violin Concerto with a couple of amendments that were requested by Hilary Hahn. This is NPR Music. I'm Tom Heisinger, and Robin Hilton is here with me and Jennifer Higdon and Hilary Hahn, and we are having a live web chat, and we have questions. Please leave your questions in the live chat room that's on this page. And Robin, I think we have a few more questions for our guests.
Yeah, this one's for Hilary. I heard when you were in Toronto performing the Higdon that you were not a fan of contemporary music. If that's true, what got you to change your mind?
That is so untrue. I don't even know where that came from. I mean, I took Jennifer's class when I was 15, and through that class I got this overview of 20th century music that I would not have gotten otherwise, because it wasn't just the violin repertoire, it was everything. And we would sit there in class listening to a composer a week, or two composers a week, or, you know, whoever was the most prolific got an extra class. But it was so helpful, and I so appreciate all of the range of classical music, from how it started to where it's wound up. And I especially can appreciate, you know, the newer stuff, because it comes out of such a varied cultural scene these days. And so that is absolutely untrue, and I don't know where that came from, and I really do appreciate it.
Another listener writes, this one's for Jennifer, a listener who wonders whether the idea of the chaconne was inspired by the Passacaglia in Shostakovich's first violin concerto.
Oh, you know, I hadn't realized. You're right. No, it isn't.
You hadn't thought of
that? I hadn't made that connection, but
there's some things in it that are so
similar.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I looked at so many violin concerti when I was preparing to write this piece. It's possible that something stuck in my head. I've actually rarely, maybe I've never even used standard forms, and it was kind of a challenge to myself in the second movement to use two chaconnes. So, I mean, I think that may have been just more of a, what if I did this, where I'm asking myself a lot of questions. What if I try this? What would happen with that sound? And so it was a little unusual for me to use an established form, but you're right about the Shostakovich. I hadn't realized that.
A listener named Matthew writes, a perfect follow-up for that. You mentioned some others, that concerti that you listened to. He wonders what inspired you to help write this concerto.
Oh, my. Well, I think the biggest inspiration for me always is the person I'm writing for. That's always number one, because I think a lot about the individual who's going to take it, interpret it, play it. And then I must have looked at 30 or 40 concerti. I really looked at them, the balances, standard repertoire, even unusual repertoire. Stephen Paulus's violin concerto I looked at. He wrote that actually for Bill Prussell in Atlanta when he had a residency. But I also looked at the Barber, Edgar Meyer's violin concerto, the Schoenberg, Beethoven, Britten. Boy, I covered the range, because you really want to look at what the instrument can do, but you can also look at how the solo instrument balances with an orchestra. And I write pretty complex lines, so trying to make sure that Hilary wouldn't have to battle an entire orchestra, it meant having to study a lot.
Now, Jennifer, you said that the biggest inspiration is Hilary, and I'm wondering if there's some place in the concerto that there's an extra amount of Hilary-ness. You know, is Hilary's personality, in other words, in this concerto somewhere?
You know, Hilary's kind of throughout, but I have to admit, when I was writing the cadenza in the first movement, the cadenza it's a pretty difficult cadenza. I remember thinking, oh gosh, I hope this is playable. And I think I may have actually even attached the note when I sent it to her.
Yeah.
If this isn't playable, I'll rewrite it, you know. But
it's completely playable.
It's totally playable.
It just sounds really hard.
So that's very Hilary, I think, is that cadenza in that first movement.
Well, let's give it a listen. I think we'll just listen to it a little bit before the cadenza, and then listen to the cadenza itself, which is,
yeah, it's good to take the context, I think.
Pretty wild, actually. It's from the first movement of the violin concerto of Jennifer Higdon, who's joining us today with Hilary Hahn for this live web chat on NPR Music. Thank you. Quite a wild little cadenza there from the first movement of the Violin Concerto by Jennifer Higdon, performed there by Hilary Hahn. Jennifer and Hilary are our guests this afternoon. So, Jennifer, that to you was a little bit of Hilary's personality, and how so?
Well, you know, she's
incredible.
You know, I think Hilary has six fingers on her left hand. I'm blown away by her.
It is pretty hard.
Yeah, it is. The technical, the leaps in it are pretty unreal. And the double stop she has to grab.
And those slides that almost sound like a horse whinnying.
Yeah, but you know the things that sound tricky are not the tricky things. Difficult ones are the things that sound like, oh, of course it goes in that direction on the violin, but it doesn't actually naturally go in that direction. And I find that very often, that people are impressed by things that technically may not be actually as hard as they sound, but the really, really, really difficult things are usually only perceived by violinists themselves. That's fine.
We had a question earlier that someone wrote in saying, how long did it take you to actually prep this concerto for its premiere?
I didn't have a lot of time, actually. I got the score not too long before the first read-through, which was with the Curtis Orchestra in
September. Yeah, of 2008.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the premiere was in
February of 2009. Yeah, so right.
So it wasn't actually a lot of time. I had less than a year. And usually I've heard something before, or I have learned it and put it down a little bit and picked it up. It's not the shortest time I've had to learn something in the past, and it's not impossible, but for something so brand new, I was also trying to learn a lot of other rep at the same time, and I had to stop that because I wasn't retaining anything. I was trying to memorize three Ives sonatas and this concerto, and I wasn't familiar. I'd never played anything before with that sort of that specific rhythmical treatment of either composer. So I was definitely overloading my brain. Once I isolated it to learning this piece, then it went much quicker. But what happens for me is when I get on stage with this concerto, it changes in every single concert. So I have to be very careful that I practice it like it's a first performance every single time before each concert, because there's so much that happens in the orchestra. There's so many chamber music moments and so much that's dependent on how each orchestra member's personality comes through that it's easy to get caught up in that and forget what I'm actually doing. So I feel like I'm still learning it, even after recording it.
You know, we've been talking a lot about Jennifer's concerto, and we shouldn't forget that there's another little concerto on this new record that's going to be coming out tomorrow. And
it was new at one point too.
Indeed, it's the Tchaikovsky concerto. And Hilary, why did you pick this one to pair up with Jennifer's concerto?
I hadn't heard Jennifer's concerto when I programmed the album, but I kind of knew her style. And I assumed that the concerto would have its own personality separate from other pieces, because that's usually what one aims to do when composing, I figured. So I didn't know exactly what it would be, but I knew the kind of sound world that it might occupy. So I thought, well, it's going to have a very strong personality, and I want to put it with something that is also substantial. I'd asked Jennifer to write a substantial work, by which I meant in length of time, but I knew that it would have a lot of complexity too. So I wanted to make sure that the piece I paired it with complemented it, but also stood on its own. And for me, they're tied. I mean, they're tied time-wise in my life. I worked on the Tchaikovsky when I was in my early mid-teens, and then I put it down thinking I'd get back to it. And it was right around that time that I had Jennifer's class. And then, you know, fast forward about a decade, and I realized I didn't get back to the Tchaikovsky, and I should get back to it. And I really enjoyed that. And at that same time, Jennifer and I were starting the ball rolling on the violin concerto. So to me, it was actually coming back to the Tchaikovsky was like something new. At the same time, something else new was happening, and it was an exciting prospect to put them on the same disc.
Well, I think we should listen to a little bit of the Tchaikovsky in the time that we have left. You mentioned that Jennifer's concerto has a lot of personality, and I think that Tchaikovsky's concerto, especially in its day, did too, and not everyone actually liked that personality. And
that's good, though. It means that it drew a reaction from people.
It drew a big reaction from an influential critic at the time, Edward Hanslick, who was complaining about the concerto at first and saying that the slow movement was almost enough to kind of reconcile him, but then it breaks off into the finale, and then some of his language is pretty colorful. He compares it, the transition and into the finale, to this brutal and wretched Russian church festival. And he says, we could see a host of gross and savage faces and hear crude curses and smell the booze even.
Oh.
So let's see if he's
funny
right.
How things change over time.
I know.
Perceptions.
Let's see if he's right. Let's see if we smell any vodka here. It's Hilary Hahn with the Tchaikovsky concerto. It's the second movement into the finale. Music from Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto. Hilary Hahn is the performer. It's on a new record that is paired with Jennifer Higdon's Violin Concerto, and they've both joined us today in this live web chat, and I would like to thank you so much, both of you. We're almost out of time, just a few more moments left for taking time to talk with us and answer questions from our listeners. I just would like to wonder if there's any other Higdon and Hahn collaborations in the future.
You just have to stay tuned.
I'm sure there will be something.
Yes. Yes, you just have to stay tuned.
So you're excited about the release of the record. It comes out tomorrow, but you can hear it in its entirety on our site, nprmusic.org. And I've been your host, Tom Huizenga. Robin Hilton's been here, and Jennifer Higdon, composer, the 2010 Pulitzer Prize winner, along with Hilary Hahn. And we would like to thank you again so much, and congratulations on the record and on the concerto. Jennifer, it's a real treat.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been your host, Tom Huizenga, from NPR Music and NPR's new classical music blog. Check it out, called Deceptive Cadence. Have a good afternoon.